Good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us once again. So tonight is, sad to say, it's going to be our last session together, but it's been an exciting journey and a fascinating one. I learned a lot. I hope you have been and will tonight. So tonight we will be discussing beyond lawful ownership, the spiritual dimension of ownership. And to do that, we will jump right into our case studies. So I'll ask Michael to please join us on page 136, and I'll ask you to read case study A, please.
David and Mark are friendly work colleagues. One day, David is terribly hungry at work and in a terrible rush to boot. He notices that Mark had stored some food in the office refrigerator. Mark is out of the office and unreachable. David reasons that since Mark is absent, he does not need the food that day and he could replace it for him tomorrow. Considering the circumstances and their general friendly relationship, David is certain Mark would allow him to eat his food.
Okay, friends, so in your opinion, may David eat Mark's food?
I've done it before.
That's a confession right there. I'm sure I have too. You say no, you say you've done it. you say yes?
I would say, apologizing to the driveway last week, I'd say yes. If he does replace the food.
Okay, it's a good thought. It's a good thought. Please continue with case study B, Michael. You'll do all three today.
Sarah strolls along the street and discovers a bracelet lying on the sidewalk. She tries her hardest to track down its owner, to no avail.
Okay, in your opinion, may Sarah keep the bracelet?
Yes.
Yes.
Depends on how hard she tried. Did she ask?
Says she tries her hardest to track down its owner. Like, seems like genuine.
Yes.
So then you say yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, let's go on with the third.
All right. Leah strolls along the street and notices Naomi at a fair distance ahead of her. She watches in dismay as Naomi's bracelet falls into the gutter. Naomi tries unsuccessfully to extract the bracelet from the gutter. She throws her hands up in despair, gets in her car, and drives off. When Leah reaches that spot, she lifts the gutter cover and succeeds in extracting the bracelet.
Okay, so may Leah keep the bracelet, or must she attempt to locate Naomi and return it? She saw her give up.
She's
got to
return it.
Got
to
return it?
Should be returned.
Return it, return it, return it. Okay? So she cannot keep it. And B, I think everyone said that yes, almost everyone for sure. And then C, everyone's saying that no. Okay. So, of course, the answers to these case studies are going to depend on how we view ownership. Now, ownership is fundamental to the whole concept of an economic system. Without the ability to purchase, to lend, to sign a contract, I mean, all of that wouldn't be possible if there isn't the concept of ownership. So that's key. And that we know. The question is, what is ownership? Now, there are two options when we say, what is ownership? Ownership could be something that we'll call like a social construct. In other words, I don't really own anything, and you don't really own anything. But in order to get by and not fight over everything, so we just establish that the things that I have are mine, the things that you have are yours. If I pay for something, it becomes mine. But it's not inherently mine. It doesn't really have a connection to me. That's one option. In other words, again, that's a social construct. Or that it's an ontological reality. Ontological, we'll be using that word. Ontological means that when I own something, I actually own it. Meaning it's not just that society agrees that for in order to avoid conflict, will call it mine. No, it actually is mine. It's connected to me. Putting this in the context of law, the question would be, what's the function of the legal system when it comes to governing property ownership and rights? So does the law create property rights? Meaning, does the law, because there are laws, the laws create the fact that I own my possessions? Or does the law recognize the ownership? You get the difference? Either the law creates the ownership, or the ownership exists independent of the law, but the law just recognizes it. So that's going to be the key here. Do I own something because the law says I do, or do I own something because I really do own it? And we're going to, first and foremost, we're going to explore two options from a secular point of view. And we're going to go to text number one. Alan, want to read that one for us, please? It's on page 138.
Okay.
Thank you. Hobbes and Hume.
Hume argue that there is no natural mine or thine.
It's an old English, so.
Yeah. And the property must be understood as the creation of the sovereign state, or at the very least, the artificial product of a convention entered into by all the members of the society to bestow stability on the provision of external goods and leave everyone in the peaceable enjoyment of what he may acquire by his fortune and industry.
Thank you. So Hobbes and Hume, this line of thinking is, this theory is, that there's nothing inherent about ownership. So my car is not actually mine. It's just a car like any other car, but my ownership of it is just because there's a social recognition of my car being mine and yours being yours. But essentially, I have nothing to do with mine more than I have to do with any other one. So it's just to avoid conflict, to avoid problematic situations. Society agrees upon these rules, and that's what creates the ownership. Again, it's not essential. I only own it because the law says I do. So that was the first option, that the law creates the ownership, as opposed to the second option, as we'll read now. David, would you like to read text number two for us, please? This is the other secular theory, and that is where ownership is more of an ontological reality.
John Locke, on the other hand, was adamant that property could have been instituted in a state of nature without any special conventions or political decisions. Locke did not base his resolution of this difficulty on any theory of universal, even tacit consent. Instead, in the most famous passage of his chapter on property, he gave more defense to legitimacy of unilateral appropriation. Though the earth be common to all men, yet every man has a property in his own person. This nobody has any right to but himself. The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his. Whatsoever then he removes out of the state of nature hath provided, and left it in, he hath mixed his labor with, and joined to it something that is his own, and thereby makes it his property. It being by him removed from the common state of nature placed it in, it hath by his labor something annexed to it that excludes the common right of other men.
Thank you, David. So Locke maintains that ownership is an inherent reality. In other words, something that I own is actually an extension of me. So just like, of course, I am me, my hand is me. When my hand does something, let's say my hand picks a fruit. If I pick a fruit, then that act establishes that fruit to be an extension of me, of the person. Now, if I go take this fruit and I sell it for $20, so the $20 is now mine. because it all extended from that action. If then with this money I go buy a computer or a table, then that becomes mine. So over here, there actually is an inherent connection between me and my possession. I kind of mixed my labor with it, and in so doing, extended myself onto that particular object of whatever it is. In other words, because I invested my toil, my tears and sweat in something, then I actually acquire it as a result. So the social construct approach is my ownership is determined by the law to avoid social conflict. The ontological reality, which was Locke, my labor on earth gives me ownership of it because I put in the effort to acquire it. It therefore becomes mine. Does one of the two resonate with either of you more than the other?
Number two.
Number two does with you?
Two.
You're one? Okay. So the truth is that U.S. law is not bound by any particular theory, but I think it seems to reflect option number one for the most part, actually. So now that's been established, let's advance to try to understand the Jewish perspective on ownership. And to appreciate this, we're going to revisit a biblical story. A biblical story of Jacob and Esau. So we all know their early life. They were born twins, and then Esau was the firstborn, but sold his birthright to Jacob for a serving of lentil soup. Anyway, the day comes when their father Isaac wants to bless his firstborn, and their mother Rebekah orchestrates that Jacob should, in disguised as Esau, would go and outmaneuver the blessings from their father, the choicest blessings. Of course, this angered Esau. Now, we all know, I guess it wasn't even necessary to mention that Jacob was the righteous one, was the scholar. Esau was the man of the field, more occupied with hunting, material pursuits, some not very ethical, etc. So, of course, this is what led Rebekah and Jacob to believe that he wouldn't be the right destination for those blessings anyway. Anyway, Jacob gets the blessings. Esau is really upset and angered, and he threatens to kill him. So that's when Jacob escapes to Aram, which is modern day, I think, on the border of like Syria and Turkey. He spent like 20, 21 years there. That's where he built his family. That's where he married Leah and Rachel, etc. And now, after all those years, he wanted to make up with his brother. He sent messengers ahead to let him know that he's seeking peace. The messengers come back and say that he's actually coming towards you with an army of 400 men. And he prepared in various ways. And this is where the part of the story that's going to be relevant to our discussion today. And this takes us to just about to text number three. So he's on the way back to Canaan. And as part of his preparations to meet his brother, and he prepared in three different ways. He prepared for war. He prepared gifts, and he also prayed to God. So what he did was he transferred his family and his possessions to the other side of a river called Yabok. Then the Torah describes how he found himself alone in a physical struggle with a mysterious character. And this is somewhat well known. And I'll read text number three. This is where we are. Jacob took his family and transported them across the stream, and then he brought his possessions across. Jacob was left alone, and the man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. This man, so to speak, is believed to be the guardian angel of Esau. It was a spiritual man, and they struggled the whole night, and we know how it ended, that he said he'll let him go if you bless me. And that's when Jacob got the name Israel. We're going to leave it at that for now as far as the continuation of the story. But the question is this. The question is, what was Jacob doing alone? Why was he alone on one side of the river after transferring his family and possessions over to the other side? If he was traveling with them and he transferred all of them, then he should be with them. Why was he alone in the first place? Seems like not a very safe thing to do, especially in a time where there was danger and potential danger involved. So, text number 4 gives us commentary from the Talmud and lets us know what was going on and why he was alone. Nick, want to read this one, please?
Rabbi Eliezer explains that the reason Jacob found himself alone and exposed to danger was because he had returned to get some small jars that had remained behind. This episode informs us that righteous individuals cherish their possessions more than their own bodies. Why do they care so much? For they never touch a stolen property.
Thank you. So instead of resolving the simple question we had of why was he alone, the Talmud seems to deepen the mystery. Because the statement that righteous people like Jacob, they care more for their material possessions than they care for themselves and their own body, seems counterintuitive. I mean, somebody righteous, you would think, is less concerned about their material possessions. Anyway, it seems you would think someone who's more materialistic would be more obsessed with their material possessions, not somebody like Jacob, who was a spiritual-minded individual. So what does this mean? So we still need more clarification. What does it mean that he was after his material possessions, and that's why he went back? He transferred his family, he went back because he left some stuff behind, and that's why he put himself at risk for those few stuff. So how do we understand this? Nick, please continue into 5, which continues the commentary on this. This is, by the way, from the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement roughly 300 years ago.
The Torah is highly protective of people's personal assets. This is a result of the major spiritual principle that whatever material items we use, the garments we wear, the food we eat, or the utensils we utilize, we derive benefit from the spiritual force present within each item. For the existence of that item is sustained by virtue of the spiritual presence within it. Specific sparks of spirituality are embedded within each item, and through divine providence, items that are used by particular individuals harbor the specific sparks that are related to their soul. As a result, when we use a utensil, eat food, or wear a garment to satisfy our corporeal needs, we thereby repair the spiritual sparks embedded within them, because we subsequently serve God with the energy that our body acquired through that item. We must therefore be highly protective of our possessions, of whatever we own, out of concern for the individualized spiritual forces they possess.
Okay, thank you. So this text number 5 is a big idea of our discussion today. And that is that when we talk about material possessions, everything physical in the world is sustained by divine vitality. Everything gets life from God in order to exist, and that's everything, not just a person, not just a living being, but even this piece of wood right in front of me, if not for the divine sparks that we're going to call them, that are embedded within it, giving it life, it wouldn't exist. Meaning, even though it was created once, it wouldn't continue to exist if not for that divine vitality, that divine life force. Now, when we talk about a righteous person being after or looking after their material possessions, what we're saying is that what they're really interested in is not the material aspect of it, but the divine sparks that are embedded within it. Because, why are they concerned with the divine sparks? Because that's really our mission on earth. God put us here. He already had angels, still has angels, myriads of angels, which are spiritual beings. Why did God put us, human beings, who are a soul and a body, why did he put us here in this world? Because he wasn't satisfied by just having angels, which are spiritual beings. He wanted humans who are spiritual, they have a soul, but they also have a body. And he's going to put us here in this world, and we're going to engage with materialism. But by doing so, for a spiritual purpose, for a meaningful purpose, we're actually going to elevate all the materialism that we deal with and engage with every day. We are actually elevating it by utilizing these things for the right purpose, to serve a higher purpose. So this clump of wood right in front of me, this lectern, is actually serving the purpose why it was created when I rest my Torah book on it. Because that's what it's here. That's why it exists. It exists to serve a higher purpose. Its higher purpose is to hold this book. This microphone's higher purpose is to record Torah, which will then be recorded and hopefully studied more afterwards. And the same with everything around us, including the food that we eat. We derive energy from the food. The food then gives us the ability to go be productive and do what we need to do. And in so doing, we elevated the food that we ate, etc., etc. Let's actually go to the screen where we will have this idea shared in this video. One's possessions contain individualized spiritual sparks. We'll talk about that in a minute, right after the video.
As human beings, we consider ourselves rational creatures. We eat because we're hungry. We exercise to stay fit and healthy. We'll even repaint our house because all our neighbors did. But research tells us that behind every conscious decision lies a much deeper subconscious desire. And the justification that we give for our decisions may have nothing to do with that subconscious desire. I'll give you a fairly common example. Take a child who's acting up, breaking things, fighting with siblings. Do they choose to act up? Definitely. Do they have a reason? Go ahead, ask them. They'll be more than happy to fill you in. Because you said this, because she did that. But behind those reasons, there's a much deeper motivation for their actions. They're seeking the attention and nurture that they feel they're not getting. Breaking a chair is a marvelous outlet for their anger. But they don't want to break. They want to bond. And we all know that there's no such thing as bad PR. They know they're going to get a ton of attention from their parents. They'd love the positive attention, but they'd rather negative attention than no attention at all. Here's another example. Maybe because of an unhealthy diet or a skipped meal, your blood sugar level drops. Your brain will automatically send a message to your body to search for an energy source. It doesn't matter if it's sweet or salty, bitter or sour. Taste is not the goal here. Energy is. But all of a sudden, you're craving something sweet and sugary. And the justification for eating that bowl of vanilla ice cream is, well, I have a sweet tooth. But if we understand that our body just needs energy and we change our diet or our schedule, we'll much better suit our purpose. Did you know that within each and every one of us lies a divine subconscious? Our soul. It has needs and wants, and it will do everything in its power to guide us in that direction. You see, God is a masterful architect, and in his divine plan, we each have a predestined parcel in this world with which to interact with. People, places, food, clothing, even ideas. Our soul seeks to bring spirituality and a higher purpose to these non-spiritual entities. It will draw us to certain people, to certain experiences, even to purchase certain items. But just like the sweet tooth narrative covers up our true energy drain, so too our rational justifications cover up our soul's true desire. Our job is to contemplate, what does my soul want to get out of this experience? What can I bring to this situation to make it more spiritual? Everything we own needs to have a meaningful use, and every action that we take needs to serve a higher purpose.
Okay, so just to bring home this idea a drop more. So I started explaining it before the video. She definitely did a good job doing so. So here's what the Baal Shem Tov teaches, to sum it up. When I am hungry for a certain food, as far as I know, I just have a craving for that food. And that's true. And that's what's pulling me to that food to eat it. The Baal Shem Tov teaches that the truth is there's something subconscious going on here at the same time. Why does my body want the food? The reason why my body wants the food is because my soul needs the divine spark that's in that food. But how's my soul going to know? Not going to know. How's my soul going to get to the food? My soul is spiritual. The food is physical. In order for the soul to tap into the divine energy in that food, the only way to do it is through the body. So it has to orchestrate that my body should feel hungry or crave that food, because that's the only way that my body is going to take in the food and then extract the divine sparks that's in it. So that's in general. But then more specifically, and this is a key idea as far as the ownership concept is concerned, souls and divine sparks are not random. Every single soul is assigned specific divine sparks that it needs to elevate. So for example, if it's me, I'm going to have a certain portion in the world that are associated with my soul, and God is going to orchestrate that whatever happens, my soul is going to wander until it encounters those sparks, so it can then elevate them and redeem them and elevate that part of the physical material world. For example, did I ever know I would end up living in Texas? No, I never set foot on Texas soil before I got the call to be asked if I was interested in moving here to establish this branch of Chabad. It could have been anywhere. At the same time, a month before, I was exploring something in Florida or something in Atlanta. Thank God none of those worked out. We're delighted. But what do I have with Texas? I didn't have anything with Texas. But my soul needed to get here because I had a certain portion of the world that only I, my soul, was associated with, and it needed to encounter. And that's why we find ourselves ending up in places unplanned. My plane landed unexpectedly in this and this place. Or we thought we're going here, but then something came up and I went there. These things aren't random. It's all orchestrated from above, because our specific soul needs to encounter those specific divine sparks. Now,
even when they're not so good, when it appears not such a good situation,
whatever happens to us is all orchestrated from above. But that's a course for itself.
Right.
Sometimes it's positive, sometimes not so positive, but it's all for a purpose. Right. Now, think of an organ transplant. Sometimes there can be a transfer of ownership in between objects. So the point I'm making here is that when I own something, okay, if I own this thing, well, I don't really, it's the shul, but let's say my phone, it's because my soul is connected to the sparks of that particular object. Now, if that's the case, then maybe I need to own everything I have forever, because they belong to my soul. So the truth is, it's just like, think of an organ transplant, even though it came from somebody, but then it could go to somebody else as well, but they have to be a match. So things that we own, they could undergo a transfer of ownership. We buy stuff, we sell stuff, we give stuff away. Now, that's not a violation of this idea of those sparks being associated with me. It just means that for a period of time was associated with my soul, and then when I'm going to sell my car, that means from above it's been orchestrated that now the other person needs to pick up where I left off as far as that particular object is concerned. So this is the concept of ownership mean is not random. We already see where we're going as far as the two options of ownership between Hobbes or Locke. You could see that Judaism is creating a very deep connection between the things that we own and our soul. So that's the idea of ownership. They're associated with me. My body and my organs must match. An organ transplant must be compatible. My soul and my possessions must match. Transference of ownership must fit the spiritual network. So when the time comes for something to go on to the next person, that means that that's what's supposed to happen on a spiritual level too. Now coming back to Jacob, Jacob wasn't concerned at all about the material aspect of those forgotten jars. He didn't go risk his life because he left a few jars behind. If it wasn't those jars, it would have been other jars. He was actually wealthy at that point. When he returned back to Israel, he had a lot of cattle. He had amassed a lot over those 20 years when he worked for Laban. So he wasn't lacking those jars. It was actually the spirituality that was within those jars, embedded within those physical objects that were associated with his soul. It's that he couldn't forego. He couldn't leave those behind, because then it would be like a piece of his soul left behind, a piece of his purpose and mission in this world left behind. That's what he was after. And that's what a righteous person values sometimes more than their own body. Because he was putting his physical life at risk in order to preserve his spiritual life. That's why he went back, although he was alone, to get those things, and that's when that encounter with the guardian angel happened. Everyone with me? We're making sense? Okay. So righteous individuals, now we're revisiting the statement from the Talmud, which was puzzling at first. We were wondering why he would be busy with physical stuff, and that should be more important than his life. Rather, let's reread it. Righteous individuals cherish their spiritual possessions more than their own materialistic bodies. So his priorities were absolutely straight because it was the spirituality of those objects that he was going back for. So, and we also ended that statement by saying that the righteous do so because they're super careful not to make use of anyone else's stuff. They're very careful not to steal. Yeah. So from this perspective, the spiritual perspective on ownership, what it means is that it certainly isn't just a social construct. Social construct meant that I have nothing to do with my stuff. It just means that socially we agree that my stuff is mine and your stuff is yours so that we can get on with life and not fight. But Judaism is clearly taking a different position than that. The spiritual perspective is that ownership is very real. My possessions are mine because my divine essence is connected to them. My mission on earth is with that particular object. The house I live in is because that is where, that's the physical space that my soul needs to be in and refine and elevate. The same is with my car.
Like a bag of tools.
That's your bag of tools, yes, spiritually speaking, absolutely. So it's real because and it's mine because it needs to be from a spiritual perspective. So, that said, now we'll...
When someone takes something from someone, I wonder what kind of effects that have.
Well, when you take something from someone, I mean, of course, that's called stealing in a very literal way. But what you're also doing is you're distorting the spiritual aspect of what's going on here. Because you're confusing something that belongs to that person's soul. You're robbing it, or you're robbing him from the ability to elevate the sparks in what's his. And that object is not mine, so I'm confusing my own soul too. It doesn't belong to me, not just because I didn't pay for it and that person did. It's a distortion of my spiritual purpose when I take something that belongs to someone else, or vice versa. Not only that, but when I use something that's mine, if I use a physical object that belongs to me, that I bought, but I'm doing it with the wrong intentions, I'm not utilizing it with the purpose of it serving the reason why I have it, to serve a higher purpose, to serve a divine purpose, that is a subtle spiritual theft to a degree. If I'm using the item that is mine, but with the wrong intention. But we'll leave that for now.
But that wasn't any divine orchestration, just that, you know, someone stole my car and
if somebody makes a bad choice, then they are making a bad choice. I don't want to get into it because it can veer us off our topic, but if somebody makes a bad choice, they can't say, well, God wanted me to steal it, and the proof is that I did, and nothing happens without God wanting it. The thief can't say that. The person...
Can that energy assist them at all?
No.
Okay.
No. It's like saying, can I eat or can I derive spiritual benefit from a food that's not kosher? I can't.
Oh, really?
That's what I thought of when you first brought this up, strangely enough.
So that's not possible because it's not assigned to my soul. Because if somebody has a Jewish soul, then the food that's assigned to them is kosher. So even if someone does consume not kosher, they can't extract the spirituality from it. Because it's not there for them. But similarly, if I take something from somebody else, then I'm, like I said, it's just a distortion of ownership. Okay, let's advance. We're going to apply this to a couple of different areas in our day-to-day life. But first of all, and David brought up the first lesson before, and he brought up the parking your car in someone else's driveway. Discussion. So, all civilized people agree that stealing is wrong. But the thing is that in real life, there are some gray areas. And that's where the question becomes. Of course, no one to steal from somebody else, everyone agrees is wrong. What about case study A? So, we talked about someone, I think it was David and Mark, who work in the same office. And Mark had some food in the refrigerator, and David knew he's not coming in, and he was hungry, and he'll replace it exactly what's there he's going to put back the next morning. Could he eat the food? So, if we want to rely on the idea from lesson one about utilizing someone's parking space, so we actually did take a pretty liberal view as far as Jewish law is concerned, when it comes to benefiting from someone else's property, even without the owner's consent. But there's a difference here. The difference is this. Then, in lesson one, we spoke about using someone else's property. Here we're talking about consuming someone else's property. Using someone's parking lot, which would remain absolutely unaffected as a result of my use, and unless you saw my car there, you wouldn't know that it was there, unless I knocked down some trees while I was doing it. Other than that, you wouldn't know that anything happened. The reality is, even if I'm friends with David, and even if I absolutely will replace that food, but right now I'm consuming, I'm not using, I'm consuming something that belongs to him. And that is a problem in from a Jewish law perspective. Because right now, he's not here, and even if he was, and I would believe, or if I would be able to reach him, he would definitely tell me to go ahead and eat it, but right now he's not here, I didn't ask him, it's his, not mine, and consuming it would be a problem. Let's take a look at the Code of Jewish Law, in text number 6. Michael, please, once again, on page 144.
If you enter a private orchard or garden, you may not pick its fruit without express permission from its owner. This applies even if the owner of the orchard is your dear friend and will certainly be extremely pleased to hear that you enjoyed their fruits. Nevertheless, since the owner is unaware of your actions in real time, it is forbidden to benefit from the fruit. This principle applies in all similar cases. The public must be cautioned regarding this law because it is commonly transgressed due to lack of awareness.
Thank you. What's going on here? Not responding. So, very important piece there from the Code of Jewish Law. So this is an approach to unauthorized use of someone else's property. And this approach, which is telling us basically that even if it's my friend, and he absolutely would be happy if I told him I enjoyed some of his stuff, we still shouldn't do it because he doesn't know about it right now. It's a very formalistic approach. It seems like a very rigid approach to ownership. But it makes perfect sense. Because if we consider the formalistic approach that Jewish law takes to ownership in general, if ownership is just a social construct, as we were saying, then if I know that my friend, we really are friends, and I know that he'll be happy that I enjoyed some of his fruit, then why shouldn't I? But from the Jewish perspective, where ownership is real, and it's an ontological reality, as we're calling it, then it's for real. Then what's mine is mine, what's his is his, and I can't just make assumptions based on the fact that socially we're friends and we're all one happy family. Going ahead and using something that's not mine, that's someone else's, factually speaking, it's considered stealing, because right now when I'm eating it, I don't have permission from him to do so. So it's worth noting, by the way, let me just see if I can get this going again. It's worth noting that there is an exception to this. When we say that when you walk into your friend's orchard, you're not allowed to eat from the fruit because he doesn't know about it, that's if it's a very irregular occurrence. But let's say you frequent your friend's place, and every time you're there, he lets you eat from it. Then let's say one time he happens to not be there, being that he continuously allows you to do so, then you can assume with certainty that you have permission even this time when he's not there with you, or you didn't ask him this time. What we are saying and establishing, that it is stealing to do so. Consuming something without the owner's advance permission is stealing. And this was case study A with the food in the refrigerator. That is true. And this would be the law if it never happened before. Or even if it did, but very infrequent. But if on a regular basis he gives the food and he lets him have it, and he tells him, yes, sure, go ahead, as long as you replace it tomorrow morning, no problem. Then if one time he happens to not be in the office, then past consent is able to permit it for a scenario where he's not there. But again, if you don't have the past consent, there's no reason to assume that he would allow you. Even if you believe and assume he would, because it never happened before, we can't just go stretch it and turn it from a social, from an ontological reality to something that's just a social construct. So, in other words, it really depends on the owner's expectation. So, that is idea, that's as far as case study 1 or A is concerned.
It seems like consuming is a major point. When we talked about parking in someone's driveway, we're not really consuming anything.
That's using.
Yeah, right.
There's using and there's consuming. When you're consuming, right now, that thing is not going to exist until you replace it.
Yeah.
or that very thing will never exist again, even if you replace it. And that, you can't just go and I mean, to be honest, you know, we'll all be, as Alan was, right? We all do these things when it comes to friends, and we. But the truth is, maybe there is some regularity to it, but we need to be a little. I certainly need to be a little bit more mindful when it's when I don't have an instance to rely on from the past, and make sure. I mean, nowadays, you know, we can always drop a text and check in with the person before actually enjoying their lunch. Yes.
But what if I said yes in case study A mainly because I thought that the guy was extremely hungry. You know, he needed to eat.
So like he needed the energy to function, maybe. You
yeah, so...
He may be diabetic or something. I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, anything short of his life being at risk, I mean, okay. Like, it's nice that you're hungry. And I mean, call the guy. No problem.
It's interesting because I think, based on our prior conversations, that Jewish law would require, in this case, that if the David in the office called his friend and asked him permission, law would require that the permission, that the friend grant the permission and not withhold the permission from him, because he can help him and he can suffer. He suffers no harm on his own part because David will be replacing the food for him. He suffers no harm for him. So wouldn't...
Yes, we did discuss that, but with one caveat. We can't compel somebody to do that, but we can strongly recommend that they do that. And we'll have something like that here too. Meaning not doing it, refusing to do it, would be a Sodom-like behavior. And we did say that we could impose it on someone as long as there's no loss. The question here is, yes, the guy is saying he's going to replace it. In all likelihood, you can trust him. We're not talking about big money or anything. But the reality is right now it won't be there. So there is a potential loss. And who knows, maybe he's coming back to the office in the evening and he just likes when there's some backup if he gets hungry. So, you know, it's certainly the beyond the letter of the law thing to do if he calls him. And listen, if they're friends and he knows him, he certainly would let him do so. But you know, we all know those people who are genuine friends of ours and say that they'll replace it exactly the same thing by the same time, and they don't always come through, you know, and we don't. It's not like we're going to get upset at them. We kind of know them, right? A good friend we know, and we can love a friend and still know that they, it's just not their strong point to come through exactly according to the detail as they promised. Okay, let's go on to the next big topic tonight of how we're applying this ownership conversation. So there's a popular saying that's called, I'm going to start it, and you continue. Finders, keepers.
Losers, weepers.
So, it may have been true in the past, but the current legal reality of finding lost property is more complex than that. So, generally speaking, if someone finds something, is legally obligated to make an effort to locate the owner and have it returned to the rightful owner. But, and this is from a secular standpoint, if a few months pass and the item isn't claimed, then the property is presumed to be abandoned and the rule of finders keepers actually does take effect. So you make an effort, but if time passes and nobody comes forward, then it's yours. Let's take a look at text 7 just to establish the lost property law. Alan, you want to read that for us, please?
At common law, a person who found lost personal property could keep it until and unless the original owner comes forward. This rule applied to people who discovered lost property in public areas, as well as to people who discovered lost property on their property. Many jurisdictions have statutes that modify and the common law's treatment of lost property. Typically, these statutes require lost personal property to be turned over to the government, to a government official, and that if the property is not claimed within a set period of time, it goes to the finder and the original owner's rights to the property are terminated.
Thank you. So that is from a secular standpoint. What does Jewish law say about returning lost property to its original owner? Let's read the verses straight out of the Torah, Deuteronomy. David, could you help us with text number 8, please?
If you see your fellow's ox or sheep straying, do not ignore it. Be sure to return it to its owner. If the owner is not near you, or if you do not know the owner's identity, take it home with you and keep it until they come for it, whereupon you shall return it. Do the same if you find a donkey, garment, or anything else they have lost. You may not ignore it.
Thank you. So how does the biblical commandment of returning lost property that we just read in text number 8, how does that differ from the secular legal position presented in text number 7? Anyone see any distinctions? Yes, Nick.
In the second one, the biblical reasoning, your rights are not terminated. You don't lose your rights because of a function of time.
Okay, excellent. I'm going to call that the third difference.
Okay.
Anyone pick up on anything else? What's unique about the Jewish approach in these verses? So let's take a look here. First of all, from the secular standpoint, you have a choice to pick it up or not pick it up. If you see something on the ground, you don't have to pick up the object. The law, secular law, tells you that you can keep walking and whatever. You don't have to be bothered by it. Jewish law says it's forbidden to ignore lost property. Did we see that in the verse? If you see your fellow's ox, do not ignore it. So we can't keep walking. We have to address it. That's number one. Number two, from the secular law, no action is required of the finder. From Jewish law, personal requirement to actively return lost property. So we did say that you should make some effort, but if you don't, if it doesn't come for, nothing turns up, so you move on in life and it's yours. It's not a required action. From Jewish law perspective, you have a personal requirement to actively return lost property. What would that mean? What do you have to do? I mean, you would
try
to find the person, or maybe put up signs in the place where it was lost. Nowadays, maybe you would send out a message on some community neighborhood chat or something like that. These are active things that one is required. It's not Mr. Nice Guy who does these things in Judaism. It's a personal obligation, just like it is to fast on Yom Kippur. It's to go search out the owner of this object. And number three, as was noted, from the secular law, if not claimed after a while, the lost property can be kept. Jewish law, no end date to returning lost property. It could be sitting by you for a year, 2 years, and then the guy comes forward. There's no such thing as saying that, it expired. It doesn't exist. And it never runs out. It doesn't. There's no expiration date on the requirement. So in the next text, number 9, which I will read, this is from Maimonides. If an announcement or notification regarding the discovered item was made and the owner did not come to claim it, the item, listen closely here, the item should remain in the possession of the finder until the arrival of Elijah the prophet. This is Maimonides in his Book of Laws. What does that mean? That it should remain with him until Elijah arrives. So this term actually appears in other areas of Jewish law too. And what it basically means is that if something's like unclear of who it belongs to, and it's not really, there's no resolution, there's no way to resolve it, and no one has like a stronger claim than the next person. So what it means is that before the coming of the Jewish Messiah, we're told that Elijah will come before and share with us the news about Mashiach's arrival. But it also says that Elijah is going to be the one who's going to resolve various areas of doubt within Jewish law and other things that remained in doubt for the longest time, Elijah is going to be the one to bring clarity to all these issues. So saying that I should hold on to this object until the arrival of Elijah is like saying that he's going to be the one to clarify or let me know who the one that it belongs to is. In other words, what are we saying here? This law expresses Jewish law's perception of ownership as an ontological reality. Because what's it telling me? It's telling me until Elijah comes. Now, we believe and we have perfect faith that he's going to come at any given moment, that we certainly desperately need him more than we ever did before. Yet, at the same time, 10 years ago, if something would have needed Elijah's arrival, it's 10 years later and he's unfortunately not here yet. In other words, what we're saying is that regardless of how much time passes, nothing could change the reality of ownership of this item. If I found it and I didn't find the owner and nothing came up, so yes, it sits by me, I look after it, but it doesn't become mine.
Usually we'll put it in a lost and found place, in a room or something.
Yes, but you would think, and after 3 years, or 4 years, or 5 years, and let's say you move to another city, like there's basically zero chance of you finding the owner. You packed up your house and moved. I mean, it still doesn't become yours. It's still just sitting in your possession. It's sitting under your watch until the arrival of Elijah, who's going to come and clarify these things. In other words, you can't change the ownership of this object just because somebody lost it and you found it. Good?
So you can't give it to a third party to take care of it, like a lost and found room.
I mean, the law says that it should sit until Elijah comes. It doesn't say donate it.
I found it. I gotta keep it.
It doesn't say donate it to a good cause or anything like that. It says it should sit. Because what if the guy does come and you're going to tell him, oh, well, I gave it away. It's very nice of you to do it, but you can give away your own stuff, not someone else's stuff.
Are you entitled to use it and benefit from it? What time you should have it?
If it's a parking lot, if it's something that would diminish.
So, for example, take the kid, say it's a goat that wanders off, right? And I'm obligated now to take possession of this goat, and I presume care for it, feed it, nurture it, shelter it, invest cost and put effort for to maintain it. The person never comes, but I can't milk the goat.
So I believe we don't address it in this class today, but I believe that if you're putting in, you're allowed to take out. Because if you're looking after it, you're not just letting it sit, of course, if it's an animal. So then whatever it produces, you should be able to benefit from. Because you're also giving it life at the same time.
Yeah, like a field. You tend to the field and you get corn out of the field, you can eat the corn.
Right, right. So far...
It all has a divine spark. I mean, food?
Correct, maybe. Correct. The question is if it's for my soul or not.
Yeah.
We all have our assigned portion. The question is if this is for me or not for me. And by the way, just as an aside, you know, this helps us... The whole concept of... you know, it's one of the Ten Commandments, which we're going to read again on Shavuot, on Sunday. This whole idea of coveting someone else's possession. You know, if we meditate on this idea, that whatever I need, whatever my soul needs, and whatever its purpose and mission is in this world, I have. If I don't have it, it means it isn't, it's not just it's not mine. It's not for me. I'm not supposed to have it. It has nothing to do with me and my soul. What my soul needs in this world, I was blessed with. And that's all it needs. In other words, if I don't have it, that's the greatest indication that I don't need it. From a spiritual perspective, not just that I don't need that house because I have my house. whatever my soul needs, and whatever I was assigned in this world or in this lifetime, I have. God will make sure I have whatever my soul needs to elevate and refine during this lifetime. If I don't have it, I'm not supposed to have it. But let's come back here. So just to sign off on case study B. So what happened? Sarah found a bracelet. She was walking on the street and found a bracelet. So I think most of us said that she could keep it. Is that correct?
Yeah,
I think most of us said that she could keep it. But now that with our additional insight, we now know that if she's strolling along the street and discovers a bracelet lying on the sidewalk, she tries her hardest to track down its owner to no avail. May Sarah keep the bracelet? The answer is no. She can't keep it. She needs to look after it. If she tried really hard, she just lets it sit until the arrival of Elijah, who will clarify who the owner is.
That's amazing. Super honest.
But you ain't seen nothing yet. No, it is amazing, and it is super honest.
I was driving on the street, you know, on Main Street, and by Rice University, or whatever, yeah, Main. And I saw this, I recognized money right away. This, it has that certain green about it. It was like...
It's not only you, Alan. Don't worry.
$60 plus dollars. Of cash. Yeah,
the green catches all of our eyes. Don't worry. So we'll talk about that shortly. Okay?
So are we saying that Sarah cannot... She has to keep the bracelet, but are we saying she can't wear it?
I mean, if wearing it could potentially scratch it or whatever, I mean, she can't put wear and tear on it.
Okay, so in that case, she can't use it.
There may be certain instances where kind of like the animal, where using it actually helps the item. Like certain things, when they just sit around, it's worse for them than using it.
Yeah.
So there may be instances there where using it in a basic way, I may be wrong, but I think the tractate in Talmud that discusses it, I think talks about books. You know, books, if they just sit around, they just could wither away after a long time. So basic wear and tear, which actually helps sustain it, may be okay. But let's advance here. And there's another big caveat to everything that we just said right now. In other words, what we said about case study B, it's true that she can't just keep the bracelet. But now let's go on. Now we are, based on everything we've discussed so far and viewing ownership as an ontological reality. So usually it means, the conclusion usually is, as Nick just said, wow, look at how honest Torah law wants us to be. And that's true. And usually it will be more stringent than secular law. However, there are exceptions. There are exceptions to this. And an example is found in the details of an exception to the law that mandates the return of a lost item. And let's read 10a and 10b, and then we'll unpack it together. Nick, please. This is from Maimonides. Both of them are, actually. Please take it away.
By mentioning the example of a garment, the Torah teaches us a law. Every garment is unique. It contains features by which it can be identified. We therefore presume that its owners will seek its recovery, and we are obligated to return it. This establishes a principle in the article that has an... I don't know why I can't read that. What is that word, Rabbi?
Identifiable.
Yeah, I'm tired. I'm sorry. Identifiable features assumed to have an owner who seeks its recovery and must therefore be returned. By contrast, a lost article that no longer has owners who seek it because they have despaired of its recovery belongs to its finder, even if it bears identifying features. If you discover a lost item on the seashore within reach of the tide or in an area inundated by a flooding river, you may keep it.
This applies even if the item has an identifying feature. This law is derived from the command to return an article that was lost to your fellow, and you found it, implying that the obligation extends to any circumstance in which the article is lost to its original owner, but is likely to be found by others. This excludes an instance in which the item is assumed lost, not only to its owner, but to all people. In such an instance, the owner certainly despairs of its recovery.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
So, these texts introduce us to a halachic concept. In Hebrew, it's called yi'ush. That word means despair. So, according to this principle, once a person has despaired of recovering a lost item, their ownership of it actually dissipates. Now it's ownerless, because if somebody lost something and they despaired from ever finding that item, so with the despair comes the release of their ownership. And now it's ownerless. So if somebody picks it up, it can become freely acquired by that person who finds it, because the despair happened by the owner who lost it. The new person who picks it up is now picking up an ownerless item. Now the question is, what does despair mean? How do we assess despair? Because we've been leading up till now, we were very clear about what the approach is, and this seems to question it all. So here's the thing. In text 10a, we established that if we find what we call a generic item, so we mentioned the garment. See, back in the day, and it may even be true to a certain degree today, but certainly back then, you didn't just go to TJ Maxx or whatever and buy shirts, and there are 100 of them the same, and two people could have an identical garment. It used to be that a garment had that person's stamp on it. I don't mean literally, but their size or their selection or their color, it expressed their specific preferences, if you will. And basically, it would have what we call in Hebrew a siman, which means like a sign. So it all boils down to this. If somebody lost something, and let's say you come back to that place the next day, and someone says, "Yeah, I found it." Now you have to prove that this thing is yours. You have to offer a sign to prove that it's yours, because maybe you just heard that somebody lost something and you're coming to claim something that was never yours. So you're questioned about it. You have to help identify it. Tell me what was unique on it. Oh, well, it had a scratch over there, or it was a little ripped over there, or it had this stain over there. And if somebody can identify a stain, other than the owner, nobody would be able to. So text 10a gave us a scenario of a generic item, which means that someone mentioned before, if you found cash, if you find a $100 bill laying on the ground in the Galleria Mall, and you look around, there's nobody is turning to it, even if you call it out, is this yours, no, and then you stand there for 10 minutes and nobody comes back. Okay, so you're holding on to it, now you're not going to leave it on the floor, and you continue shopping. And even if you come back there once more, an hour later, before you leave, so what's happening here? The person that lost $100 in the Galleria Mall, and let's say, who knows, an hour later, 2 hours later, realizes, or let's say when they get home, they realize that it's gone. Chances are, they're not going to go back to the Galleria to try to recover it. And that's because they have no way to prove that it's theirs. So they're going to come back and say, well, this $100 was mine. First of all, they don't even anticipate that it should still be there a couple hours later. Even if it is there, who says that we should believe that person? There's no way to identify a $100 bill. Well, maybe the numbers on it are unique, but well, when's the last time you studied the numbers on your cash? So there's no way to identify it. It's generic. If something is generic, that basically means that the person who lost it disappeared. That's That's possibility number one, how we can assess the spirit. So once a person has the spirit of recovering a lost item, their ownership of it dissipates. Their role has been completed. This is already from the spiritual perspective, that, and it's time for someone else to channel its spiritual energy. Now, if this actually happened, the second option in 10b, we learned that that if something was found in a place where, let's say, a flood was happening somewhere, or somebody found something, as we said, within reach of the tide, or there was a flooding river and something was lost, somebody found something right there. There's no way, now the person who lost it has absolutely no hope at all to ever reclaim that item, because they know there was a flood there, or was right next to the tide of the ocean or whatever, and there's no reasonable possibility that item should still be there intact or that they should find it. So if that's where you found it, then that too is a fair assessment that the person dispersed of that object. So in these scenarios, we're able to assume that the person did dispersed of it. And if they did, then the item is ownerless. And when the person finds it, they are picking up the ownership of this item at that point going forward. So, and just by the way, in order for this despair process to actually take effect, they have to despair of the object before I found it. So only if they despaired before I found it, then when I find it, I'm picking up an ownerless item. But if they didn't despair yet, and they still are hopeful that they'll find it, and that's when I picked it up. So when I picked it up, it still had an owner. And if it still had an owner when I picked it up, then this falls into case study B, to Sarah who found the bracelet in a normal scenario. And it doesn't become mine. It only becomes mine if the despair happened already. When would we say it happened already? If, let's say, if it was a very heavy object, or if it was very valuable, and it's quite certain that a person will realize very quickly that they lost it. If it's something heavy, you know right away that you lost it if you don't have it. If it's something really valuable, you know, we all know people, maybe even ourselves. I know, like, before I leave the house, I feel three pockets: my phone, my keys, and my wallet. If one of them aren't there, I'm subconsciously not going to really leave the house. Maybe I won't make it to my car, certainly if it's the keys that are missing. But if I'm lacking one of those, there's like an imbalance if all those three items are not in my pockets. So if it's something that you'll feel very soon, then, I mean, think of your phone, right? I mean, if you wherever you carry your phone, you'll notice pretty quick if you suddenly don't have it. Now, depending on where you lost it, you know, of course, we'll try to go back for our phones, unless it was, you know, a flood or whatever. The point is that if the person didn't come back, they certainly realized immediately that they were without it. And if that's the case, then by the time I picked it up, they already disappeared, releasing their ownership and allowing the finder to actually be the keeper. So
you're saying that the act of disappearing occurs or is actually tied to the acknowledgement or recognition by the former owner that they have lost the item.
Exactly. Exactly. And I believe you'll see that in text 11. And this is from Rabbi Yehuda of Prague. Let's see what he writes, please. Want to read it, please, David?
Yes. your property is not a part of your body from which you cannot be separated. Rather, it is your possession, something external that belongs to you. Therefore, if you lose an item and it is no longer in your possession, and you have also removed it from your consciousness through abandoning the hope of its recovery, strict principles of ownership dictate that it is no longer yours. It is ownerless.
Thank you. So yes, we've been speaking a whole night about the ontological reality as far as ownership is concerned from a Jewish perspective, but that doesn't mean that our possessions are inseparable from us. We weren't born with it. We acquired it at a certain time. And we can also end our ownership of it. And this is one of those ways. This is one of the ways, because when an item is legally removed from one's possession, then this is where we come to this, that their role has been completed and it's time for someone else to channel its spiritual energy. So that that helps us understand how this is an exception to the rule of the ontological ownership. So that the spirit dissipates the ownership, the relationship is severed from that item, and then the new owner is then free to acquire it. So now if we come to case study C, which was regarding a bracelet also, but this bracelet fell into the gutter. Okay? And who was it? I think Naomi, Leah and Naomi. So Naomi was losing the bracelet into the gutter, and Leah is watching this unfold and actually sees her try to get it, but she is unsuccessful, and she throws up her hands and just says, forget it, I have to go. And then Leah follows up and puts in the effort and is actually able to extract the bracelet. So we asked, who does it belong to? So if we take what we just learned about the spear and applying it to case study C, what will we now have? So generally a bracelet does have signs. It's not a generic item. It has a specific shape, a design. It has scratches, meaning you could identify it if you were to come forward and try to reclaim it. So generally, and going back to case study B, if you find a bracelet, you can't just assume ownership of it because there are signs on it. It's not generic. So a person doesn't despair a bracelet, right? Because they don't despair a bracelet. That's why in case study B we said Sarah can't claim ownership of it. It just has to sit in her possession. Because if the person does come forward, they could identify it based on the specific characteristics of this bracelet. But we're not in case study B anymore. Now we're in case study C. And here it fell into the gutter. And there was water running through the drain, and it fell in. Then certainly it's like a flood. But even if there's no water running through it, the fact is that her behavior made it clear that she gave up on recovering it. If that's the case, and then Leah saw, and she was able to use some tools to open the drain cover and extract it, Leah has no responsibility, according to Jewish law. She has no requirement or obligation to track down the owner, and is legally entitled to keep it. Because there was despair, the despair released the ownership, and then Leah picked up on it afterwards. That's a good reaction. That's a good reaction. It sounds unfair, right? And Jewish law concedes that it is unfair. So first of all, read text 12 for us, please, Michael.
Naomi didn't have the tool to lift the
plate. Okay, she could have looked around. She could have asked Leah if she had a tool, or knock on someone's door or window and say, you know,
she didn't make any effort.
We got to get creative. When my car dies, I start asking people in their car if they have jumper cables or whatever. Go ahead.
Text 12. All of the above accords with the letter of the law. Nevertheless, the good and proper course of action is to extend yourself beyond the letter of the law and return a lost item, even if its owner already despaired of its recovery.
Thank you. So this is what David alluded to before. So yes, the letter of the law will tell Leah that she could keep it, because the process, we have to honor the process, and there was a dispute, and legally she could keep it. But that's the letter of the law. But in this case, she actually saw what happened. If she saw what happened, then she knows. Well, we're taking for granted that she knows Naomi. But if you don't know the person, you just saw the person kind of experiencing that, and they get into their car and leave, it's very possible there's no way to find that person again. If you know who it is, and there is a chance for you to get it back to the owner, then there is an expectation that one should go beyond the letter of the law. Legally, it's yours, but you definitely should do whatever you can, even if there was the spirit, to get it back to the original owner.
It's interesting here that the letter of Jewish law parallels very closely conventional common law and U.S. property law generally. And the idea of abandoned property is that if you abandon property and someone else then can claim it. And the idea is that there's a societal benefit to people utilizing property. That property shouldn't go to waste, but it's better that somebody is making productive use of assets and resources.
That's really interesting.
For the benefit of society at large, right? So it encourages someone to take possession and use it.
Yeah, great point. Thank you for sharing. So, case study C, legally entitled to keep, although the finder is counseled to show kindness and go beyond the letter of the law. So,
Jewish law? Letter of the Jewish law.
Correct. So Jewish law will say that she can keep it, but she should go beyond what's legal and try to get it back to its owner.
So all that money that was found in Lakewood Church in the bathroom's wall, did you hear about that?
No.
From what I heard from another plumber, that this guy was doing commercial work at Lakewood Church, and he's repairing some pipes in the wall, and he opened the wall, and there was all this money inside there in satchels or whatever. And so there was some explanation given as to why it was there. I thought that was astonishing.
After Harvey, when I was repairing my house, and they took off some of the sheetrock under the steps, we found an empty can and an empty bag of lunch from the person that built the house 25 years ago. No cash.
I found beer cans in attics and stuff fixing people's homes. Yeah.
But there's more than one story. One is standing out, which I just remember hearing or reading probably like 5 or 7 years ago, of somebody in Connecticut who bought like a desk on Craigslist, a Jewish religious guy actually, and you know, they were, whatever, at some point they were going through it, and deep in a drawer they found like the tons of cash, and they got it back to the owner, even though, I mean, it was cash, and you know, I mean, the person sold it and moved on. Like, they could have gotten away with it, but it was thousands of dollars. It was maybe even, I don't remember, maybe even tens of thousands. I'll try to look it up.
Maybe God gave him that opportunity in order to show other people that Jewish people are honest. You never know.
Absolutely. It's a test. Not easy. When it actually happens.
Sure.
So in the final analysis, what we still need to understand is, if Jewish law is conceding, as Michael said, that this isn't fair, why are we allowing her to take ownership of it if she you know, watched this happen? She watched the person fall into despair. Why would Jewish law allow this to happen in the first place? So for that, we have a little bit maybe we won't read the whole text. I'll let you read it on your own time. It's not a short one in text 13. But the point that's being made there is this, that life isn't always fair. The reality is that from Jewish law perspective, we end up, you know, we're taking the ontological theory that we're deeply connected to our possessions. So sometimes we end up with stringencies, and we did for most of our discussion today. And we can't just become an owner of something else that doesn't belong to us, or just assume that the person would allow me to use it, etc., etc. But at the same time, there is this concept of despair, where where we end up more lenient than the secular law approach. And in other words, it's the thing is like this. In other words, if we trust Jewish law, then we have to trust it all the way. And sometimes, in this case, in this particular discussion, it's going to end up more strict, but then in one instance, it will end up being more lenient. And even though it doesn't seem to follow the principles of fairness, so to speak, but at the same time, we're also called upon to go beyond the letter of the law and make it right, even when there was despair. And then, so let's just catch up here. So coming back to John Locke's view, possessions are extensions of our body, and the Baal Shem Tov's view is that possessions are extensions of our soul. So what does this tell us? What this tells us is we have two, if we want to kind of look into it a little bit deeper, we have two different ontological views. So both John Locke and the Baal Shem Tov taught that we are deeply connected to our possession. Unlike Hobbes, which said we're not, that John Locke and the Jewish approach both agree that we are connected to it. But what was Locke's approach? That because I used my hand to pick something, or I worked I put in sweat and toil, so that something became mine as a result of the work I put in with my body. The Jewish approach is that our possessions are extensions of our soul. And if that's the case, what Locke tells us is basically how we own something, because we used our body to earn it, so to speak. What Judaism tells us is why we own something, not just the how, but the why. And the why is that everything we have is because we have a certain mission in life, a certain purpose, and whatever tools we need to carry out that mission, God provides us with everything that we need, and we are spiritually aligned with the spiritual sparks, the divine sparks in everything that we have, and therefore this also leads us in, and we'll conclude with this idea that in Judaism we have a commandment that we're not allowed to destroy things for no reason. We're not allowed to destroy a tree. We can't just wantonly destroy property just for fun, because everything that exists has a purpose, and it's given to us to use productively, and not just. Want to just close off, Michael, with 14a and 14b, please.
14a is when you lay siege to a city for an extended period of time as part of a battle to capture it, do not destroy its fruit-bearing trees.
Thank you, and go on with Maimonides, please.
This prohibition is not restricted to fruit trees. Anyone that shatters utensils, tears garments, destroys buildings, plugs a natural spring, or ruins food with destructive intent, transgresses the Torah's prohibition of do not destroy.
Thank you. And that's true about anything. I mean, growing up, you know, in school or certainly at home, you know, the smallest thing, Jewish law tells you not to destroy. Even just to pull a branch off of a tree, or just for no reason, just to destroy something, even if it has little value, we go to very far distances to avoid any of that. So we need to value our possessions. We are entrusted with them for a reason.
Lesson 5.
I guess let's hear the summation.
Beyond lawful ownership. 1. Jewish mysticism teaches us that only